Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My returning guest tonight is Associate Professor of Literature at Trinity College, Sarah Bilston. And tonight we're talking about her book, The Promise of the Suburbs, A Victorian History in Literature and Culture. Sarah, welcome back to the show. It's a real pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Thank you, and it's lovely to be back again.
Yeah, this book really surprised me. I had no idea what it was going to be about. And then when I read it, it was like really fascinating. How did you get interested in the Victorian suburbs?
So, yeah, I mean, my very first book had been about representations of adolescence in the 19th century. And for that book, so this is quite a long time ago, I got really, really interested in Victorian popular fiction. And what I mean by that is really a lot of fiction that nobody has ever read, no one has ever heard of. And because I really wanted to sort of, I didn't just want to read the familiar books, you know, sort of the Jane Eyre type novel, although I really enjoyed those, but I really wanted to kind of figure out what else was going on in the 19th century. So I read a lot of pretty obscure novels. Actually, just as a side note, what was fun about that was these were often books that had never, literally the physical book had never been read. So I read them in the library, the Bodleian at Oxford, and I literally was slicing open the pages in order to read them. That's how much they had never been read. But anyway, I started to notice representations of lives unfolding in the suburbs, and they felt really unfamiliar, right? So there were these books that had never been read, and then the lives that they were representing, I felt like I hadn't read these stories in, you know, the Brontes or Dickens. And one I particularly remember was set in, now I'm just going to have to describe this. I think you'll probably know what I mean. It's like a city block where the residents of the block all have a shared garden in between them. Do you know what I mean? And you can only even get there if you have one of those houses and you go out the back, right? And the whole plot of the novel was about the interactions that would take place in that garden. And I found this really surprising. I just had never read anything like that before. And the idea that Victorians were even experiencing that this was a sort of a city design, seemed unexpected. And so I just kind of made a mental note of it while I was writing that book. And as soon as it was done, I thought, well, are there more of them? You know, could I find more novels that represented lives in specifically in the suburbs? And what I found was the answer was yes. And so the book really was my effort, first of all, to discover the novels that were written about the suburbs. And then as I kind of started increasing my focus, nonfiction written about the suburbs. And in general, to try to work out how did the Victorians think about this new development? And above all, why didn't I know about it?
It's a really conflicted idea about the suburbs. Talk to me about, first of all, physically describe the suburbs vis-a-vis large cities like London. So we're not talking about the countryside.
No, right. No, exactly. And I mean, one of the points that I make in the book is that they're so diverse and so varied that it's so funny that the word suburban has that pretty flat meaning that we all now recognize, right? Like everybody kind of knows what you mean when you say, oh, it's suburban, and it's generally you know, it generally doesn't mean good things. And that meaning was in place really very early in the period. And it's funny that that meaning is so flat, given that the suburbs were as varied and diverse as they were, because what we're talking about is a whole bunch of different things, and I'll just gesture to a few. So one thing that would happen is that as building pushed out from the center, it would swallow up what had been villages. So some suburbs were areas that had formerly been really quite separate villages, really quite rural. Whereas others were totally new, and they were areas that had been farmland in between the villages. So these are sort of constructed really within a very short period of time, and are built, you know, in different ways at different moments. But I mean, a sort of standard way in which they would be developed was by speculative builders who would buy the land, and then they would lay out streets. And then as they got funding, right, from people, from being able to sell the properties, they would then build another street and another street and another street. These areas all had very, very different characters. The ones that have been villages, for instance, places like, I'm just going to focus on London for a minute, places like Hampstead and Highgate that had been very leafy, they were much more likely to be lived in by sort of fairly well-to-do members of, they were often writers and artists, and really quite affluent people, like basically the richer middle class, the more well-positioned. Whereas places like Camberwell, those tended to be more working class. Some were very racially and ethnically diverse. So they had an astonishing array. Some were much more working class. Some were much more upper class. But even street by street, there would be a huge variation. And for example, if a factory moved relatively close and the smells wafted over, then a street would lose its class. So it was very fluid. It was a very dynamic picture. And then I also started to do some census research and discovered just how incredibly diverse residents were. People were coming from all over the world. What I came to think was that the flattened term suburban, it was really interesting that that developed so early, given that you can't say this is what the suburbs were like, because they were incredibly heterogeneous.
Now, I want to stop you there, because one of the wild things is the criticism that the suburbs got. For instance, H.G. Wells called them the catastrophic multitudinous of suburban development. There was just this intense disdain for the suburbs. Now, some of it was, and we'll talk about that a little bit later, some of it was based on criticisms of the architecture. But a lot of it seems like just sort of class hatred. The suburbs were really a place of the middle class. And it was like the moneyed people in London really looking down their nose at these suburbs.
It's extraordinary. And I found that loathing of the suburbs as early as the 1820s. And again, I found that just remarkable, that it was enough of a phenomenon that people bothered to hate it. Do you know what I mean? It was really common to sort of articulate this loathing of it. And that, I think, had been taken pretty much at face value. What I found striking was that very well-known historians of the 20th century of the suburbs pretty much took at face value that they were an awful place to live, because that statement of loathing was so ubiquitous. So everyone was like, this thing happened, it developed, it was really rapid, it kind of took over the landscape, and boy, was it awful. And what I thought was astonishing about that was, why would people move there if it was really that dreadful? It just didn't seem to me that humans are, generally people have a pretty good sense, right? I mean, they're not going to move in vast numbers if it's just such an awful experience.
Weird to read in your book the language that was used to criticize the suburbs: vulgar dystopias inhabited by aliens. Hideously dull
language, right?
Hideously dull and tasteless wasteland. That was TWH Crossland.
He especially hated it. Yes.
Oh my God.
He really hated it. I mean, he wrote an entire book just basically in which he poured vitriol on the suburbs.
So what happens is all that vitriol filters down to the fictions that were written in the day. And the fictions are bizarre. Because they go beyond dull and repetitive. The suburbs become this weird sort of evil place.
Yes, almost as if they have a mind of their own.
Yeah.
They're sort of taking over in this kind of dreadful, monstrous way, sort of subtly destroying Britain, right? Absolutely. Yeah, and so, as you rightly said, I think a lot of this turned out to be not just about we have to be cautious about assuming that that's literally what life was like in the suburbs, and recognize the degree to which I think in the 19th century, people were deeply anxious about so many changes that were happening so incredibly rapidly, right? And the suburbs were this very visible manifestation of the growth of a new middle class, right? also people who and social mobility generally, right? And I mean, one of the points I also make in the book is that, you know, remember, the new middle classes, they moved a lot. We tend to think of home ownership, right, as something that we all aspire to, but Victorians really generally rented, and then they would move as their class situation improved. And so the new middle classes in the 19th century were very, very, very mobile. And I think the loathing or the fear, the anxiety about the suburbs really encoded this deep angst about social change generally and about the new visibility of the middle classes and their way of life. So then when we kind of get to the fiction, what I then thought was interesting was it's not just elites who are representing the suburbs in that way. It's the middle classes themselves. And that, you might think, is an odd thing, right? Why would so many middle class writers write so critically about effectively themselves? And I do think that's an odd phenomenon, but I also think that's actually a deeply Victorian phenomenon, that the middle classes were very anxious about themselves. And so what they tended to try to do was distinguish between, you know, basically the good middle classes and the bad middle classes. And the good middle classes were people who lived, who were just a little bit different, and who didn't just, like, inhabit their house unthinkingly, but who, for example, cultivated a beautiful garden or read really intellectual books. And generally, they didn't live in quote unquote a suburb, but they would live in an area. And what they would tend to do in these novels is they would give it the name. They would say, you know, Hampstead or Highgate or Camberwell, and then they would have a totally different set of associations with the name of the place. And then they would contrast that with suburb, which was kind of like everywhere else. So it becomes this elaborately complicated effort to distinguish between, you know, me, I'm a person of taste, I'm not like the rest, and the suburbs, the masses, that's everybody else.
I had never heard of any of the books and the novels. However, you know, it's like I've read Wilkie Collins, obviously I've read The Moonstone and The Woman in White. But the novel of his, which now I feel like I have to read.
Oh, it's Basil, right?
Yeah. Like, what's that? That sounded wild.
It's wild. Yes. Yes. Absolutely. Yeah. This is a novel from the 1850s. Yes. And people may, you know, there have been some really good adaptations of some Wilkie Collins novels, right? Like The Moonstone, The Woman in White. But Basil is one of his earlier novels. And it is a really strange text.
Well, I read your summary of it, and it really intrigued me, but it was bizarre.
Yeah, it is very bizarre. And it is, I mean, again, you know, here we have a middle class writer. And again, I think one other thing that writers did and that Wilkie Collins does is, you know, they pick up on something, they see something that the culture is anxious about, right? And their job is not then to sort of say, oh, actually, the suburbs are great, the middle class life is great, but rather to kind of to tease apart something that they recognize their readership is feeling and is worried about. So, I mean, the suburbs are almost a character in that novel, right? And they're very sort of threatening and they're very, very scary. What I found fascinating in that novel was the word new is like, it's not a positive thing. Huh. So if, you know, for example, if you open, you know, if you go to a house and it's new, if the door hasn't been used much and is new still, right, in that novel, that's a bad thing. it may seem counterintuitive, but again, it's this recognition that a landscape is going up so quickly, everything is new, and I suppose you can kind of imagine it must have felt really strange, right? Just for instance, the fact that you are living in a place that no one has lived in before, and that your parents and grandparents have no exposure to and have never lived in. The whole novel really turns on how threatening it can feel to have to kind of figure everything from the ground up.
Well, I want to add, just as background, and you make it very clear in the book, that the 19th century in Britain, it's the first time now that more people are living in the cities than in the countryside.
Yeah, that's one of the big takeaways of the 1851 census. We tend to think of suburbs as places, and I think so much of our sense of what the word suburban means now is about fleeing the cities, right? We tend to read suburbs as places that people go to kind of escape, you know, what they perceive as urban problems. But that certainly in the early waves of suburban growth in the 19th century, it's the other way around. People are fleeing the countryside, which is perceived as declining in a way of life that's coming to an end, and they're moving towards opportunity. They're moving towards a new way of life and towards modernity. And that, again, I think sort of changes a little bit the you know, the representation of the suburbs. And I mean, one of the things that I found really interesting was, unsurprisingly, perhaps, although it did surprise me initially, a whole genre of literature has to kind of emerge to help people cope with, basically self-help books that help people cope with this new place and with these new kinds of homes.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My returning guest tonight is Associate Professor of Literature at Trinity College, Sarah Bilston. Tonight we're talking about her book, The Promise of the Suburbs, A Victorian History in Literature and Culture. Sarah, one of the big things is the garden. I want to focus on that for a couple of minutes. Who was John Claudius? Is it Loudon?
Loudon, yeah. What an amazing character he was, right? He's one of those Victorians that I just can't even believe how much he did. He worked so hard. It is said of him that he died literally standing on his feet, and I kind of believe it. He worked so hard. He was a hugely prolific writer and editor and journalist and landscape gardener. Yeah. So he wrote this book in 1838 called The Suburban Gardener and Villa Companion. And again, I just thought it was interesting that already by 1838, there's this whole massive book written to help, people who are now living in the suburbs. And right from the start, the design of the standard suburb includes a garden. And in the time that Loudon is writing, they're really big, and they get, of course, smaller over the course of the century as land becomes more expensive. But the whole point of that book is that it's aimed at these new suburban dwellers. And interestingly, by the way, the book is subtitled "For Those Who Know Little of Horticultural and Rural Affairs." So already by 1838, he's assuming a population that isn't living with the land, that hasn't grown up with the land, or that has very little understanding for how to grow things. And so he is suggesting that, you know, you should read your book if you want to figure out what to do with your garden. You know, you didn't grow up in the countryside, but you've now got this spot of ground, and what are you going to do with it? And he's very clear that what you will not be doing is raising food to feed your
family.
That's
right. This is gardening that's about aesthetics, self-cultivation, and what he called gentle exercise.
And it's a
whole different idea about gardening.
Absolutely. So you are not raising food to feed your family. And he says you're going to buy that in the market. You know, so that's not what I'm going to do at all. And even when he's helping you figure out, for example, how to espalier your fruit, the point is not about maximizing yield. It's about making it pretty so that you guys can look at it from your house, right, and from the garden. So it's a very different sort of relationship to gardening. And then he basically argues, right, as you just said, that the reason you're going to garden is because you've got a job in the daytime, so it's a little sort of delightful exercise in the evening and on the weekends. And, of course, it also allows you basically to signal your class status that you have leisure time. That you're the kind of person who's not kind of engaged in drudgery, but that you are, again, a member of the new middle class.
Now, I want to speed this along because I want to make sure I get this point in. The role of women gardeners was crucial to the ideal of the suburbs. And this is where you get to this point in your book, it becomes really obvious. This is a feminist history of women becoming empowered to even take on their own business.
Yes.
And so I want to talk about, women gardeners were very important to this whole thing.
That's absolutely right. And actually, Loudon, I give him credit. His wife was also a very important garden writer in the 19th century. She was also an editor. And so she was one of the first, but there were a number of women after her who write books aimed at women, right? And we tend to think, again, I think of the suburbs as having been dreadful for women, and I'm not saying that everything was, you know, I'm not saying everything was rosy, but obviously women gardened, because a whole genre of magazines and books aimed at women gardeners emerges in the 19th century, suggesting that there was a pretty significant market. That plot of ground in the suburban landscape that many houses had was an opportunity for women and to garden. And books and magazines aimed at women gardeners basically argue that not only is it an opportunity, but it's one that women should take up, that this is a way to beautify the nation. And insofar as women's role tended to be, right, that your job was to extend your influence, to make the world a better place, to make it more beautiful, and to counter much about the Industrial Revolution. This was often what was pitched to women in the 19th century. It wasn't just be obedient to your husband, although that clearly, of course, was part of it. It was also your job is to counter much of the Industrial Revolution, right? Your husband is going to go out. He's going to come home kind of besmirched by the landscape, but you, through your benignant influence, will sort of make everything better.
Well, that brings up the point that there also women became involved in interior decoration.
Absolutely. And that was another way, right? Like, you can make the home a more beautiful place through interior decoration and through gardening. And obviously women were so, what I argue in the book was they had so much experience, right, of gardening and as well, actually, of interior design. I think it's not accidental that those are really about two of the earliest professions that women list on their census returns.
That's right.
As professional work that they're actually engaged in. By the end of the 19th century, I think most would agree the preeminent professional gardener in Britain was a woman.
That's fascinating. I found that really fascinating.
Yeah.
However, there was blowback about that, because there were people who would write, to be in suburbia was to be in a woman's world.
Yes. And I think, again, particularly by the end of the century, this is partly why there was so much loathing of the suburbs. It was because it was increasingly held to be a woman's space. It was increasingly held to be a space where women were really in the ascendance. And that book you mentioned earlier by T.W.H. Crosland, I think his loathing, he really loses the plot when he talks about women in the suburbs. right, and so that I think that loathing, which was very much about the rise of the middle class, becomes as well increasingly about the rise of women and about the ways in which women were perceived to be sort of somewhat in control of the suburban landscape.
It was a whole different attitude towards the garden, too. It was really looked at the villa garden as an oasis. And there were some interesting debates, like, about wild and natural versus formal modes of gardening. There were some, and this ties into the book we first talked about orchids. Yeah. I mean, there were all these exotic plants that were coming into Britain at that time.
Yeah.
So people who were doing gardening were having very serious discussions about what makes a good garden, an aesthetic garden, and this debate about wild and natural versus formal modes of gardening is at the center of that.
Yes. And so I think this must have been, and it seems to me that it was from books and magazines, a real opportunity for women to be in on a really quite sort of raging debate. Whereas in the middle of the century, it was generally held that a beautiful garden was in some sense a display of technical innovation
and
Britain's kind of expertise, right? That very formal gardening model. Later in the century, and women were very key in this, were arguing that actually what a beautiful garden was the kind of naturalized plantings, basically, and an embrace of the perennial as opposed to the annual, which, of course, tends to be raised under glass and is often imported. So there was a big sort of move towards and a celebration of indigenous plants by the end of the century, native plants. Absolutely, women were playing key roles in that. A common complaint that they made, too, about the suburbs was there was often this sort of floricultural debate, right, this claim that the suburbs were being too slow to give up on annuals. And there was a lot of arguing that women needed to take up the charge and they needed to push back, even a claim that men were the ones who were too fond of annuals. It sort of sounds funny, but a claim that men loved annuals and they loved box parterre with geraniums in the middle of it, and that what women needed to do was show the charms and the benefits of basically following the, you know, the natural cycle of the seasons rather than sort of trying to overset it by using plants grown under a greenhouse.
It's amazing. John Ruskin, who obviously is a sort of an evil guy, no Ruskin from before, he criticized this whole thing and centering on the fact that women's artistic labor was, quote, an idle pastime, merely a personal act. What a rectal sphincter.
Yes. I mean, that's absolutely right. I mean, there was a strong sense of that, you know, this a real effort to kind of push back on women's work in the garden. But again, I think when we read Ruskin's critiques, you have to sort of realize that he only bothered to make them because there was so much work that women were doing in the suburbs.
I know.
Because they were publishing so widely. And I think it can be, you know, this goes back to the point I was making at the beginning. If you don't read the women's literature that has tended to go by way, then you don't really know how to understand Ruskin's claims about women's work, right? That only makes sense if you begin to appreciate the vast amount of literature that women were actually writing about to document, explore, and to encourage other women to be involved in decorating, beautifying, gardening the suburbs.
We're completely out of time, and we could talk about this book for so much more. But it's a really fascinating read. My returning guest tonight is Associate Professor of Literature at Trinity College, Sarah Bilston. And we've been talking about her book, The Promise of the Suburbs, A Victorian History in Literature and Culture. Sarah, it's been a pleasure.
Oh, it's such a pleasure. So nice. Thank you very much for having me back.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.